Hello, this is Christopher Long,
John Dolan,
Debbie Haughey,
and Mike Hogan.
We are Liberal Arts Voices. Hello, this is Liberal Arts Voices, episode 41. And today we are with Mike Hogan and Deb Haughey, who are the co-directors of the Center for Democratic Deliberations. So we're excited to have them today, and it's perfect timing for that because just came off the big election. This is, what's today, Thursday?
Thursday the 8th
of November, 2012, just after the re-election of Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you guys could talk a little bit, just to start off, about what the Center for Democratic Deliberation is.
Do you want me to start?
Yeah, sure, yeah.
I will start.
One of the founding directors?
Yeah, so I was one of the founding co-directors back in 2006. We, with the encouragement of Dean Welsh, formed a Center for Teaching, Outreach, and Research focused on the quality of public deliberation and discussion. Initially, it was an effort to bring together a group of people who study that topic in primarily in the English department and the Communication Arts and Sciences department, but it has since expanded significantly beyond that. We have affiliated faculty and graduate students from across the university. And we support, as I said initially, research on the problems facing our country in terms of the quality of our public deliberation and discussion. We have a number of teaching initiatives that we've supported, primarily focused on how we teach the basic communication courses, and Deborah Haughey is in a better position to talk about some of those things. And we also engage in a number of outreach projects. We have partnerships with the National Constitution Center, other Kettering Foundation, other organizations that are committed to promoting civic education and improving the quality of public discussion.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's a very specific kind of meaning to deliberation here, right? It's not, when you think about kind of debate and mm-hmm. and argument,
mm-hmm.
that's different from deliberation, is that right?
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. It the idea of deliberation runs a little bit counter to those things, in as much as the goal of deliberation is to both listen and participate.
Mm-hmm.
And engage other alternative perspectives and really think out loud together.
In public, right.
Although I would say, you know, I mean, deliberation is used in a lot of different contexts and it means different things to different people.
Right.
You know, the Senate likes to call itself the world's greatest deliberative body, but it doesn't really live up to some of the ideals
right.
that we would like to see, perhaps. And we aren't necessarily opposed to debate. I mean, debate
right.
has kind of gotten some bad connotations
yeah.
from the talking head talk shows that call
right.
themselves debate shows. They really aren't debate
right.
shows, to my mind. But, you know, a lot of people in communication studies in particular, our graduate students, a lot of them come out of backgrounds where they participated in intercollegiate and in high school debate. You know, that exercise has become highly competitive and very oriented toward it's more of a game than a
right.
than a substantive engagement of topics. So we're actually even trying to redefine what
mm-hmm.
intercollegiate debate is.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's part of our project. So, yeah, you know, deliberation encompasses a lot of different
right.
things, and it occurs in a lot of different contexts.
So, I mean, you focus both on the research as an academic discipline,
yes.
working with faculty in both English and
mm-hmm.
communication
mm-hmm.
arts and sciences, but then also engaging students. So I wonder, so we just got through these quote-unquote debates from the presidential debates.
Yeah, absolutely.
That
yeah.
What did you guys think of that from your perspective in terms of, you know, certainly there was a lot of this gamesmanship element
mm-hmm.
to it. There was a lot of the way in which the media obviously participates now, even with social media, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's been very interesting. I know you had a debate watch
mm-hmm.
a few weeks ago for the third debate.
It was the
second debate
on,
mm-hmm.
I believe, was it October
16th?
The town hall.
It was the town hall format.
We chose that one on purpose
mm-hmm.
because it's it features citizens more prominently
right.
Than the other two, which didn't feature them at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it took questions from the audience. And so that's why we chose that one. And it's funny, too, because I was very pleased with the kind of deliberation that followed the debate.
Uh-huh.
We had maybe 150 people come out, and it was, you know, got to be about 11:15 at night.
Wow.
The debate had been over for about 35 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I think they went over for 5 or 6 minutes,
mm-hmm.
and people were still there wanting to, you know, talk about it,
right.
talk about issues. And so it's funny how, you know, even the traditional kinds of debate can foster deliberation, and they can kind of go back and forth. But at the same time, you know, in terms of the point you were making, that particular debate watch had a headline contest, and the headline, of course, ended up having a boxing metaphor to it.
Yeah.
And so
they almost seemed
kind of
to come to blow at one point. I mean, the visuals of what was going on backstage. I mean, there was a whole interesting visual rhetoric that was happening
there. Oh, absolutely.
Well, and part of the debate watch is part of a larger. There's a national program that actually the Commission on Presidential Debate sponsors that is called Debate Watch. We called ours Debate Watch Party, and distinguished
pizza.
And distinguished it, you know, we aren't really connected with the Commission on Presidential Debates, and in fact, I'm quite a critic of the Commission on Presidential Debates, so I won't go into that. But part of the idea was to turn off the TV the minute the debate was over, and
forget the spin,
and you know, shut off the spin, and let people make up their own minds in conversation with people that may have some different points of view about it.
Yeah.
Well, and can you talk a little bit about the crowd of 150? What was the mix between students and community members and faculty, would you say?
I think I just judging from, and this was a quick glance, we'd have to look at some of the photos Kim took to verify. You know, there were a few, not a ton of faculty members. Quite a few, maybe I would say a quarter, maybe between an eighth and a quarter, were graduate students. There were a lot of undergraduates. One thing I did notice that I'd like to work on is that there were more men undergraduate students, way more than women. And I wonder if, we were talking about this in a board meeting the other day, I wonder if that is a commentary on, you know, how the interest goes on campus, or if it has to do with the form of the debate.
Yeah. Right.
I know that a lot of people are really uncomfortable watching the debates and just want to avoid it.
It was funny because I love watching it. And for me, I get a cathartic effect out of live tweeting.
Yeah, just the tweeting
because
was fun.
You know, which is, of course, another thing about when you talk about turning off the spin. I mean, already at the very beginning, even before the beginning, there's a lot of stuff going on Twitter, and if you're following along that way. But, you know, I know my wife, she came in for 2 seconds, she couldn't stand it. Mm-hmm. You know, she wanted, you know, Obama to do so well in this case, and she just went back to doing, you know, as I said, tell me when it's over. Like, meanwhile, I was, you know, rapt. Now, I don't know if it's a gender thing or what, but...
Well, there's actually a lot of research on gendered reactions to different kinds of communication styles and that sort of thing. There was also some evidence, for example, that women reacted very negatively to the way Joe Biden was behaving in the vice presidential debate.
Yeah.
He was very aggressive, kind of in his face, ridiculing, mocking his opponent. So there are definitely those kinds of differences. And, you know, going back to what I talked about earlier about the style of intercollegiate debate today, which is very competitive and very intense and fast talking and all of that kind of thing. There's a lot of concern in the debate community that women are not interested in participating in intercollegiate debate.
Well, I mean, and with regard to intercollegiate debate, the same thing is happening, I think, on the presidential level. This focus on winning and losing.
Yes,
exactly.
Right? Is
that part of the critique that you have with
regard to it? I think so, yeah. You know, and it's even, you know, it's kind of interesting. It goes even to the metaphors that people used to talk about, they're all metaphors of war and combat and marshaling evidence and, you know, crushing the opposition. I think that there's definitely significant gender implications of all that. And there's a lot of research on that. And that's some of the kind of research we're eager to support as well.
Mm-hmm. So do you when you talk about this in classes and in other contexts, what are the other kinds of metaphors? I mean, this war metaphor certainly goes way back, you know, but, you know, as we talk about that in philosophy classes and things, we try to think of other kinds of metaphors that you can use. Are there, what kinds of metaphors do you talk about then to get more of a, less of an agonistic dimension to this?
Dialogue.
Yeah.
Well,
Mr. Plato.
Right, exactly.
Well, an interesting one is Cindy Griffin and some of the other champions of so-called invitational rhetoric in our discipline talk about are metaphors of dance and metaphors of courtship that could supplant metaphors of war and combat.
Right. Yeah. No, that's interesting. But we find that with our undergraduates, it seems like there's a too easy. I mean, our culture in general sort of slide into this winner-loser competitive aspect.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think our colleague John Gastel, the head of the Communication Arts and Sciences, has a take on debate, which is, you know, in the context of a presidential election, it's quite useful to see, you know, the positions kind of laid out next to each other, and right. that's the function mm-hmm. of debate there. I don't know what metaphor that would be, but in terms of, you know, the compare contrast, mm-hmm. right? But I think that so easily, because we have a two-party system, you know, it so easily leads directly mm-hmm. to this kind of win-or-lose.
Right.
And you know, that's one of the things following the election that I'm a little bit concerned about, and some of our colleagues on the board are concerned about, the kind of polarized discourse, you know, all the unfriending that's been happening on Facebook, before the election, but even after it, this is purely anecdotal, but I think it's probably verifiable.
Yeah.
You know, people feel like... people who voted for Barack Obama are now gloating, and the kind of judgments that are being cast, you know, in terms of where the vote was cast. So, So I don't know. I mean, I think that that's something we're going to be exploring in the future and figuring out how to, you know, redirect the conversations.
Right.
Well, there was one thing that part of a line from Obama's victory speech that I think speaks to this issue about when he talked about. The vehemence of the argument and the need for argument as being core to our liberty, that people mm-hmm. are around the world dying for the right to have this kind of an argument, but that it's really core to what it means to be free people.
Mm-hmm.
And, okay, it's great to say that, but of course it's really hard to embody it and
right.
live it.
Right.
Yeah, and I think there he's talking about dissent, political dissent, which... we could talk about it. Maybe a pretty different thing than the sort of, polarized.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'd have to go back to look at the specific
mm-hmm.
passage,
yeah.
but because I took that as the debate that they were having, the argument that he and Mitt Romney had over the course
Got
of
it.
The last year or so, which exactly was this, which is falling into the issue that you're also bringing up about
mm-hmm.
people unfriending. I mean,
it.
You know, I had to, I admit, I had to mute a few people on my Facebook account before the, they were family members.
Well, it often is family members.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, which is actually very interesting. I mean, I've noticed that not only family members, but some undergraduates who I know who are couples
mm-hmm.
who are on different sides of the political spectrum, and I really admire that. I don't know that I could live that kind of relationship, but they seem to be able to do it.
Did you see that meme going around with the Romney Ryan sign and then the sign next to it that was handwritten, this is the dad, the mom and the son don't agree?
Well, actually it's funny, when I was going and doing a little bit of canvassing, they had it broken down even to that level where you would knock on the door and just you should talk to this
right.
you know, the 18-year-old daughter
right.
and the 45-year-old mother or whatever
mm-hmm.
and but forget about it doesn't say forget about the
right.
other people in the
mm-hmm.
Household. So they and that's an interesting thing that's
mm-hmm.
I think happening with all
mm-hmm.
the data that we now have on
mm-hmm.
people.
I would like to talk about some other data, though, because
yeah.
I think we have a tendency at this particular moment to maybe exaggerate the degree of polarization in the American public, and in fact, a lot of the polarization is within what some people call a political class that live and die politics. It's the most important thing in the world. If politics isn't the most important thing in the world to you, I can see you having a girlfriend or a boyfriend who has a different political view.
Right.
If that's
right.
not something you live and breathe.
Right.
So I think that's characteristic. If you look at the survey research of most Americans are somewhere in the middle, or confused, or
mm-hmm.
understand the complexity of the issues that are involved, and don't think they have it all figured out. And I think that's the hope for the future. And giving that broad. Kind of middle ground public a voice,
right.
I think, that they don't now have is something that is part of my mission in life. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I mean, a voice and also an ability to handle complex issues with nuance and to give, right? So that's part of what a voice is, right?
Yeah. And the main, if you ask people like that, what's the most important issue in the campaign, often what they say is getting the two parties to work together and solve these problems,
uh-huh.
and that voice is not being given enough play on the media.
Right. And I think mm-hmm. the party system plays into that too,
yes,
right?
Absolutely.
Because there, you know, there's a playing to the base.
Yeah.
And
yep.
you know.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of structural and there's structural impediments to overcoming that polarization.
Mm-hmm.
So.
I found the quote, if you want me to read it. Okay, so he says, this is just, you know, maybe in the first third of the speech, democracy in a nation of 300 million can be noisy and messy and complicated. We have our own opinions. Each of us has deeply held beliefs. And when we go through tough times, when we make big decisions as a country, it necessarily stirs passions, stirs up controversy. And I think this coming up is what you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That won't change after tonight, and it shouldn't. These arguments we have are a mark of our liberty.
Uh-huh.
We can never forget that as we speak as a people in distant nations are in that people in distant nations are risking their lives right now just for a chance to argue about the issues that matter, the chance to cast their ballots like we did today.
Uh-huh.
And so he's featuring argument as an American.
Right. A
yeah.
mark
value.
Of our liberty.
Yeah,
right.
yeah,
mark
I love
our
that
freedom.
Quote.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
I think you tweeted it.
Yeah, exactly. I was enthralled with that one
yeah.
at the time.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great speech. And I mean, he ran on that as an issue, basically,
yeah.
in 2008. And I
mm-hmm.
think that resonated
yeah.
with a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
But it is interesting. You know, I don't want to turn argument into a dirty word.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know, we
right.
used a textbook in the early version of Rhetoric and Civic Life
uh-huh.
called Thank You for Arguing,
yeah.
because
right.
you know that is that it is important to argue
right.
and weigh the evidence on
yeah.
the you know opposite sides of some
right.
of these issues.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to, there's a concept in rhetorical theory of deliberation in good faith, and it's
mm-hmm.
that in good faith, which means you have a commitment to the truth, you have a commitment to respecting people who disagree, and you have a willingness to change your mind if you're
right.
if you're faced
mm-hmm.
with compelling evidence on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
You're not a fanatic, you know,
right.
and you have a view toward the common good, and that's what we've sort of lost maybe in some of the,
mm-hmm.
the context of the campaign,
mm-hmm.
but and that's what Barack Obama's trying
yeah.
to get us to remember,
yeah.
I
right.
think, in
right.
this speech. You know?
Yeah, I mean, that idea of a view toward the common good also,
mm-hmm.
I think, has embedded in it this notion of a common and what we're
mm-hmm.
what we have in common and what we owe to one another as part of a community in that sense. And I think that, but one of the things I wanted to ask more about was, I mean, first of all of this is, all of what we're talking about is an example of why it's so important to have a Center for Democratic Deliberation,
mm-hmm.
to have courses like Rhetoric and Civic Life, to have courses on communication arts, because
mm-hmm.
students need to learn. That's part of being
mm-hmm.
an educated person,
right.
is to be able to deal
Absolutely.
With difference, to deal with people who honestly differ in ways
mm-hmm.
that make you uncomfortable.
Right.
But that brings me to this other issue that I've been thinking a lot about, which is the question of play and playfulness. Because
mm-hmm.
I think a lot of times we get so earnest and we get so wrapped up and so caught up. And some of my Republican friends who I appreciate the most have an element of playfulness about the whole thing
mm-hmm.
that allows it, that we sort of turn to when we kind of are feeling ourselves maybe getting a little bit frustrated. Is that something that you talk about? And I don't know in those exact terms, but.
Well, I mean, I think it play and comedy. I mean, if you think about Jon Stewart
mm-hmm.
and Stephen Colbert, there's a reason that they, and Sophia McLennan argues this in her book, there's a reason that those sorts of programs really took off after 9/11, maybe to balance the kind of somberness and the seriousness, but
right.
also because we were in a situation where, you know, the core values of our country were, you know, being seen as under threat, and
right.
I don't mean by terrorism, but
yeah.
I mean by perhaps our leaders. But
right.
So that's a kind of interesting way to go. But I do think just on the sort of interpersonal level, you know. Jokes can, and if you think about memes too,
yeah,
right? Like
yeah.
jokes can really create that path of, you know, these sudden bursts of thought, right? And these
yeah.
juxtapositions, and you know, and I think that can be really productive. And it's kind of, I mean, people have written about this
mm-hmm.
certainly. I mean, there's a lot of stuff on political satire, and
right.
yeah.
And I think that this, you know, this goes way back, way back.
Right.
I'm right now working on some. Sort of Byzantine era speeches where comedy figures really prominently, and I'm trying to figure out, okay, what is the educational dimension of this? And I think that, you know, Aristotle has a line in his treatise on the rhetoric where he says, you know, comedy can bring quick learning, right? Like sudden realization, like this burst of insight that maybe other modes don't allow.
Yeah.
And so I think it is productive, and I think that that's where people like Stewart and Colbert are so effective. You know, it's, right. it's surprising that it's not happening kind of in other parts of the political sphere in a way. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Yeah.
And on a related, you know, but slightly different angle to respond to your question, you talk about you have Republican friends. I think part mm-hmm. of the problem with the polarized folk, the political class, is that they are now live in these echo chambers where yeah. all of the, they only associate with people that think the way they do. Yeah. They only attend to media that confirms what they already mm-hmm. believe,
yeah.
and that leaves them open to accepting these demonizing portraits of the
yeah.
opposition,
right.
to
right.
where they think that, you know, that anybody who votes Democratic is evil and wants to destroy mm-hmm. destroy the country. And that's a big challenge to,
yeah.
to overcome that. It's a media problem.
Yeah.
It's an
right.
educational problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's a sociological problem.
Yeah.
It's a urban design problem. It's a, you
know, yeah,
it's
yeah,
a,
yeah.
You know,
well, and also speaks to the importance of the of diversity in its diverse sense,
absolutely.
Namely, right? So that, you know, that's why I think as an educational institution, we should strive for diversity. Political diversity,
mm-hmm.
as well as
absolutely.
Ethnic diversity, other kind
yeah.
of different
mm-hmm.
viewpoints. I mean, that's what an educational institution is designed to
absolutely.
be about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we another event we had this year, you probably remember, was that we held another debate watch, and this was the John Stewart Bill O'Reilly debate.
Uh-huh.
And afterwards, I talked to some of the students who were in the audience, and they were really sort of bummed out because they couldn't hear a centrist place,
mm-hmm.
you know,
right.
the applause was always for the really sort of lefty stuff that
uh-huh.
Stewart was saying,
uh-huh.
or for there was a Bill O'Reilly, you know, corner up in
uh-huh.
the back,
uh-huh.
and it's funny. I mean, I wonder if the question is more about, you know, the sort of centrist place at the comic table, or if this kind of event draws only kind of people from further ends of the spectrum
yeah.
or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean. But I think
well,
that was
kind
important.
Of set up for it, right?
Mm-hmm.
A little bit
mm-hmm.
that's
yes,
or, yeah.
I think so. Although interestingly, I felt like those guys really got at some of the issues in a pretty substantive way. And there were times when Bill O'Reilly was practicing good faith deliberation in a way that he maybe isn't deemed to be. You know?
People look at me funny when I say it, but I make distinctions among people on Fox News. I think Sean Hannity, I would label a propagandist.
Mm-hmm.
He simply repeats the same talking points again
mm-hmm.
and again in
mm-hmm.
an effort to kind of badger people into mm-hmm. accepting that position. And, you know, Bill O'Reilly sometimes surprises you, and, you know, he's a little bit more open-minded and a little more tolerant, I
mm-hmm.
think. I bet he hangs out with liberals sometimes.
Yeah.
And he's funnier.
He is funny.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly. I mean, I think there is this capacity to be, to and also to mock oneself, to be
yes,
not
right.
to take
yeah.
yourself so seriously.
Exactly.
That you know, I always root that hyper earnestness, that rigidity with a deep sense of insecurity,
mm-hmm.
and whether you can be a little bit playful with your ideas.
Mm-hmm.
It just makes for more interesting conversation, but I think you can have deeper kinds of conversations
absolutely.
That are not so alienated and
right.
alienating if you can
yeah.
talk
mm-hmm.
with one another.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah.
But you make a very important point about the role of the university, though, in kind of exposing young people, and you see the results of that in, you know, in the surveys of the college student attitudes, that they are much more tolerant of, you know, the differing points of view
mm-hmm.
than some of the younger people that aren't in college or don't go to college, just because they are exposed to
yeah,
those folks
right.
and they meet them and talk to them and they're friends with them.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I think the center has done a great job in terms of providing that platform for discussion and helping to unpack complex issues is the blog that was launched this summer,
mm-hmm.
and I think that was basically in conjunction with the release of the free report. Was that
it was.
The
yeah.
stimulus
mm-hmm.
behind that? So can you talk a little bit about kind of how that came about and the results as you've seen them so
yeah,
far?
Yeah, sure. Well, it's a tricky thing, you know, with this such a huge sort of unprecedented kind of scandal, and with our being all sort of embroiled in it and in the middle of it and talking about it as it's going on and unfolding, we sort of cast about for the right kind of venue, you know, my first impulse, I think, which was a wrong one, was to get people together and talk about it. And luckily I had colleagues who were like, well, this is still ongoing. I mean, that could go really badly.
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, that's a time when, you know, thankfully we do have these other resources and we were able to, you know, think of another option. I mean, I don't know that it's ideal, but to put up blog posts to encourage, and this is one of our concerns, online deliberation.
Yeah.
It has its own problems, you know, as opposed to face-to-face deliberation. And so to try to model and encourage productive, engaged, you know, respectful, good faith deliberation. And so we have guidelines for that. And it's funny, once the semester hit and people got busy, it's really hard to get people to follow up on and make new posts. But, you know, this thing is still going on. So I don't think it's dead. I mean, what we want to do is, you know, move the blog to other issues eventually. We want to have it serve a kind of healing, healing might not be the right word, but a function of giving people voices here and now for this issue. But we have in mind for it, you know, a future where we can talk about all kinds of issues and still, you know, foreground deliberation and think about, okay, well, how do we facilitate productive online deliberation.
Right. And the resources that Debbie and her team put together on there already, again, they were prompted by that particular controversy, and much of it is focused on that, but it also is useful for a variety of other contexts because it emphasizes kind of the critical attitude one needs to take toward media coverage of something
like
that, because, you know, I think a lot of us I've never quite experienced a what I would call a media feeding frenzy, like that. And I think that was an eye-opener for a lot of our students to go through that and be walking to class and be ambushed by reporters trying to interview anybody who would talk to them. And just seeing how different the reality that appeared on their screen was from the reality that they had experienced personally. So there's some resources that they put together on that about how to think about you know, issues of media coverage and other kinds of and larger institutional issues involving Penn State and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. There was a great story that I heard from Sam Richards in the Whirling Conversation Project. They had been having prior to this these conversations with students in the Middle East, Muslim students in the Middle East, using video conferencing, and all of this came down last November, and the riot happened, and the next week the students were in the discussion with the students from the Middle East, and the Middle East students said, "Oh, it looked really bad there. What's going on? Is everybody okay?" And this Penn State student said, "You don't understand. The media covered that in a way that made, you know, the way it was cropped, the way everything looked, it made it look way worse than it really was." Mm-hmm. And the students from the Middle East said, "You see what we've been saying to you for the last year of conversation? That's what we're talking about. Uh-huh. Now you understand what we're talking about."
Right,
so there was a real learning moment, I think, for people.
Heartening.
Really. But I mean, I think the other issue with particularly with the scandal here at Penn State is the pitfalls of trying to deliberate about something in which you're so wrapped up and implicated just by virtue of being a member of the Penn State community.
Yeah.
That has a lot of different kinds of dimensions that, you know, it's difficult to kind of parse out.
Yeah, and that's why the first entry for that blog is called Deliberating in a Fishbowl. You know, and I think the thing is, we move in and out of the fishbowl. Everybody does, not just faculty, but students, you know, go home. It changes a little bit, or at least they're, you know, they're interrogated a little bit by their family, you know, what's going on there. And I think I've heard that students are just a little bit tired of having to talk about it and being held accountable. But also, one point is kind of like, this is life. Sometimes you don't have a choice.
And we're coming up on the year anniversary, I guess, tomorrow.
Yes.
So,
It was depends on how you count it. I think it was the fifth.
I think the fifth is when it broke.
The presentments and all that stuff. Okay.
But
the firing and all that stuff.
Is coming up.
Oh, boy. It's just one of those things that keeps going in waves, you know. So if students want to get involved with CDD, how do they do it?
Well, they, you know, we have internships. We have, we do have a contest for.
We do. We have it. Well, it's not actually a contest. We do have an award.
Award. Sorry.
We have a through the support of one of our generous donors is endowed an award that's called the Burkle Student Engagement Award, which we give every year to students who make significant contributions to. Deliberation on campus or in the community, and this past year we awarded it to, not surprisingly, three students who were very involved in organizing the candlelight vigil at Old Main, and to another student who was involved in organizing students to fight breast cancer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and it's open to. Nominations from both of undergraduates and graduate students, and and so yeah, we'd like to encourage any faculty who might hear to mm-hmm. nominate students that they know that are very involved in some fashion on campus and getting people to discuss important issues or making a contribution to the quality of public discussion.
Maybe it would be good to have the winner, this year's winner, on another episode.
Oh, that's a great idea.
That would be a good idea. And then Debbie did mention our internships, and maybe you want to say more about what we have. We have some wonderful interns mm-hmm. this year, and they're doing some interesting things.
We have one intern in charge of social media, so she's sort of enlivened our Twitter account and visibility there. We tweet at Democratic Delib. And we have others working on various initiatives like Voices of Democracy, a sort of bank of historic speeches, and the other thing I would say is that we're developing other events specifically geared toward undergraduate students, you know, deliberative events, mm-hmm. Not just the debate watches, but those are always going on when there are important elections. But we have some of those on the horizon that I would just sort of watch out for, and we'll send them through your office.
Can I have one more? Sure. Time for one more thing. Yeah. One of our interns, actually three of our interns also were trained as public forum moderators with the State College Public Issues Forum, which is part of a national movement funded by the Kettering Foundation to create public issues forums across the nation. It's called the National Issues Forums, and they're gaining very useful skills that they can use mm-hmm. in business and whatever activity.
Yeah.
I was going to say one other thing that undergraduate students are very involved in. We are the chief sponsor of the Penn State Debate Society, which is a revived debate society after Penn State kind of withdrew its support from competitive intercollegiate debate because it became kind of, I think, counterproductive. Mm-hmm. You know, it became the hyper-competitive, fast-talk style of debate. The Debate Society is a student organization. It's coached by volunteer graduate students, and they're experimenting with different models of debate, like more public issues forum type debates mm-hmm. and parliamentary style debates. So that's something that there's a good, you know, maybe 30, 35 okay. undergraduate students now involved in that. So that's something that that students might get involved with too.
Great. Well, thank you for all the good work that you guys are doing. It's really great to hear about and participate when I can. Yeah. And it's really awesome.
Thanks.
So this has been Liberal Arts Voices.